Okay, you are in the Practical Theology Sunday School class, and a couple weeks ago we finished a series of Practical Theology where we went through and studied some of the major shuns of the Bible, some of the major theological topics. So we looked at predestination, we looked at regeneration, right, sanctification, justification. We looked at all those shun words and even some more, and our base camp was in Romans chapter 8. And we did that because in order to be good counselors, we need to really understand where the best counsel is, that being the Bible and Scripture, really understand how salvation works, how God works in us and through us in salvation, so that we can understand what God has called us to do and how he works in us, but also so we can help encourage others with that same information. So we finished that series, and now we're continuing this practical theology theme, but we are branching off, and we are concentrating on the attributes of God. And so the series we've kind of titled is Knowing the Great Counselor, the Attributes of God in Biblical Soul Care. Last week, Russell went through and talked to us about the aseity of God, his self-sufficiency, his self-existence. And then this week, possibly next week, we are going to talk about God's holiness. That's holiness. And I think what the goal is when John, Brock, and Russell and I got together and talked about how we wanted this series to go, what goals we wanted to achieve, we really want each of these attributes to help guide you in learning how God's attribute affects how you live your life, how it can counsel you through struggles with sin, through trials, suffering, and also just how to counsel you in appreciating and adoring and understanding God more and more. And then I think the other thing that we were hoping to accomplish as we go through is that this will train you and put tools on your tool belt for counseling others as well. So we want these lessons to be somewhat succinct and concise. We're not necessarily trying to plumb the depths of systematic theology and all that it has to say. We're not necessarily trying to explore all the mind-boggling depths, but really trying to gain a lot of fruitful application from each of the attributes of God. And one of the things that I hope to do, and I know the others as well, is with this handout, I hopefully have put material in here and questions in here in such a way that you could take this blank handout and sit down if you're discipling somebody and walk through it and help them learn about the holiness of God. So hopefully it's a little different than maybe previous handouts that you've received over the past couple months. But that is the goal, and hopefully if you have any feedback about how I can make it better, I'd be very much open to hearing it. But that's kind of my goal with the questions, is to be able to have you guys. And what I'll do is I'll email it out as a PDF, and you can keep it on your computer, and you can use it whenever you feel like it. But with that being said, let's look at this introduction on page 1. 1 Peter 2:9 says this, "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light." Now, based on that verse, according to 1 Peter 2:9, what is God's purpose in saving sinners? Absolutely, yeah. You have that purpose clause there, that you may, so it's the purpose there, the end to which he has saved us. We're not saved just to be saved, but we are called to a purpose, and as Anne brought up, it is so that we may proclaim the excellencies of him who called us out of darkness into his marvelous light. So then the next question would be then, what are the excellencies of God? I certainly think that's part of it. I think when we talk about his excellencies, it certainly is his attributes. I didn't say his acts, his actions as well, right? When we proclaim the wonderful things, right? It says we are proclaiming the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. So yes, it is his attributes, but also the fact that he called us out of darkness into his marvelous light. When you look at the psalmists are often praising and thanking God, not just for who he is, but for what he has done. How often you see the Old Testament saints look back, even on things that were generations before them. You think about like the Exodus, always looking back to that and praising and thanking the Lord for that. So I think excellencies includes his actions as well. But for the sake of the lesson, it definitely is his attributes. This following quote is from MacArthur Mayhew's Biblical Doctrine. "The attributes of God are his characteristics, the various aspects of his essence or nature. The term perfections, derived from the Greek term aretas, which is what we just read in 1 Peter 2:9, or excellencies, works better than attributes because perfections specifies that the characteristics of God are each perfect and inherently characterize the God who is perfect. The term attributes does not inherently specify perfect characteristics and might hint that these originate in someone's concept of God rather than God in God himself." Now, when we talk about perfections, a general definition of perfections is as follows. God's perfections are the essential characteristics of his nature. Because these characteristics are necessary to his nature, all his attributes are absolutely perfect and thus rightly called perfections. Further, since these perfections are essential to God's nature, if any one of them were denied, God would no longer be God. So, question number three, why is the term perfections more helpful to describe God's nature than attributes? Barry just kind of points out the fact that when you talk about attributes, it could be misconstrued that you're the one attributing the description to God, right? Rather than it being inherent of himself, almost kind of putting yourself in a position of labeling and categorizing God rather than him setting the standard. What else? What else is perfections kind of a more helpful word? Perfections, it's already kind of what we touched on, the idea where it is inherent in God. And I think that's what's a key statement there from MacArthur, is that in that second paragraph, when he defines perfections, God's perfections are the essential characteristics of his nature. His perfections are who he is, which is what is said here in this next paragraph at the bottom of page one. God's essence is identical to his perfections. There is no essential distinction between God's essence and his perfections, and there is no essential difference between God's perfection to one another. Each perfection characterizes God's complete essence simply and eternally. That is to say, God is what he has. He does not merely possess love, justice, and goodness. He is love and justice, eternally, fully, and completely. God is eternally all-powerful, all-holy, and all-loving. So why is it important to... Now, I don't think it's wrong to use the word attributes, by the way. Right? Steve Lawson's not wrong for having a DVD series on it. Other books are not wrong for using it. You can just kind of see where like that term perfection just kind of like, yeah, I like that better. That's like, you know, glorifying God more if I use that. But it's like, I get what you mean if you use the word attribute. If I use the word attribute, because I'm going to, y'all understand what I mean. But it's just kind of the goal of pointing that term out is to say God is what he is. His essence is his attributes. He's not part love. He's not sometimes love. He doesn't show love sometimes, and then when he gets angry, he's showing wrath towards sin, and he's no longer loving. He's not the sum of his parts. He is all those things. And that's why that mind-boggling paragraph from MacArthur, I mean, I just spent some time trying to think about that, that the essence is identical to his perfections, that there's no essential distinction between God's essence and his perfections. There is no essential difference between God's perfection to one another. Amen. That's right. I don't know whose kid that is back there. So why is it important? Last question on page one. Why is it important to strive for precision when talking about God's perfections? So Josh kind of touches back on 1 Peter 2:9, right? Our job, right, if we're believers, if we're saved, we've been tasked with proclaiming the excellencies of him who called us out of darkness. As heralds, not knowing when Christ will return, we're called to herald his excellencies. And we're called to do so truthfully, honestly, clearly. So it's important that we represent as ambassadors of Christ the one who sent us accurately. If we really want to have good counsel to give to people and really explain God correctly, we need to understand and be precise and not sloppy with explaining who he is. And sometimes, you know, Russell mentioned, you know, a lot of times unbelievers can have these misconceptions about God, or, well, he's just this wrathful, hateful being. But even Christians can sometimes struggle in their theology when we don't understand God's attributes, his perfections. We can have this, maybe a lot of you, I know I grew up this way, but maybe some of you also have heard it, where you kind of look at the Old Testament and you think, man, the Old Testament was, God really showed himself as this really hard and wrathful God, but in the New Covenant, he's more loving and gracious, right? The Old Testament was a covenant of works, if you've ever heard that statement before. And the New Testament is a covenant of grace. Well, that comes from a thinking of separating God's attributes out. That he can be one way during one dispensation and during another time act a different way. That he turns off his grace and turns it on at a different time. But that's a misconception of how God is in his being. He's always gracious. He's always perfectly loving. He's always wrathful against sin and against things that rebel against him. He is always merciful. So you see, and we see, when you look at the Old Testament, you see God's grace everywhere, right? Even just in Iron Man, as Alvin was preaching on Isaiah 6, you see God's grace to Isaiah. As Isaiah sees the holiness of God and recognizes his sinfulness, and he wants to disintegrate. He feels like he's going to disintegrate and says, "Woe is me." What does God do? "Yeah, you're right. Woe is you. I'm going to strike you down right now." No. He forgives him. He cleanses him his sin. God shows him grace. He doesn't say, "Well, you know, you followed the law pretty good, Isaiah, so I'm going to go easy." No. He shows him grace. So it's important to really be precise. Let's turn the page, and we're going to look at God's holiness this week. We're going to start with Isaiah chapter 6, looking at verses 1 through 3. "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called to another and said, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory.'" And so we see God's attribute of holiness clearly put on display in this passage. And we want to work towards the definition of holiness. So look at question number 5 there. Why is the word holy repeated 3 times? Why not just, "Holy is the Lord. The whole earth is full of his glory." Why 3 times? Yeah, Adam. Yeah.
Typically, you repeat something once, that's all the emphasis. Mm-hmm. Repeat it 3 times, it almost never happens. It's far beyond the concept of amplification.
Yes, absolutely. So Adam pointed out this is a literary device used in this Hebrew writing to show emphasis. And so, you know, when we write something, like an email or a paper, how do we show emphasis when we write something? What's that? An emoji? Yeah? How far we have fallen, right? An emoji. Thumbs up. How else do we show emphasis when we write? All caps? Yeah. Italics? Underline? Exclamation points? You good, right? I really, really mean it, right? We can repeat ourselves too to show emphasis. Yeah. So what does this indicate about this attribute when you see this repetition, this emphasis? What is it trying to say about this attribute?
He really, really means it.
He really, really means it? That's
good. In that, listen up, pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know this is it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and this is, you know.
Anybody else?
Is there something within the 3 that also related back to perfection? I know it was used for emphasis, but it also, I remember somebody telling me something about it being with perfection in there too.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're real right on there. And so when we see this repetition of 3 times, it's an emphasis of degree. And so it has a sense of, when you have it repeated 3 times, a sense of completeness, right? It is the most superlative degree. So I think what we want to be careful is not to look at this and say, because one could look at this and say, man, no other attribute in the Bible is repeated three times. That must be mean that this is the most important attribute. Well, no, then you've all of a sudden divided God's essence, right? He is all of his attributes, all the time, perfectly. So none are elevated above another. No, this is a superlative to say he is the most holy being ever. He's not just holy. He's not just holy, holy. He is holy, holy, holy. Nothing ever comes close to that. Let's emphasize the degree. There's a couple examples that we see in the scriptures I just put in the side reference there, where you see emphasis like this and to the superlative degree again. So the example you see a lot in the New Testament when Jesus is talking, where he says, truly, truly, right? You see a double emphasis of the word amen, amen. And so he's really saying, what I'm about to say to you is true. And Jesus shouldn't have to say that, but it's an attention-grabbing device to the disciples. This is real. There's a humorous example of this literary device in Genesis 14:10, where if you usually in your English translation, it'll talk about these bitumen pits, these kind of pits that you could fall into. Well, in the Hebrew, it's literally the pit pit. The pit pit. And the point of it, again, is the superlative degree. It's not just a pit. It is the pittiest of pits. That's literally what it is trying to emphasize. That's the worst kind of pit to fall in, is the pit pit. Not just a pit. It's the pit pit. Now, when we say, this is Heath Lambert in his book, A Theology of Biblical Counseling. When we say that God is holy, we are saying that God is devoted to himself. And that's an interesting thing to think about. Whenever, this tags off right off of Russell taught last week with God's aseity, with his self-sufficiency, with his self-existence. All of God's attributes, including his holiness, are first and foremost directed to whom? Himself. He doesn't need us. He didn't create us out of some felt need. He didn't create us so that he could, okay, now I can show my grace, right? That's what the concept of the Trinity is so important as well. Because he was manifesting these attributes within the Trinity to himself for all eternity. When we say that God is holy, we are saying that God is devoted to himself. Many have pointed out that the only threefold repetition of an attribute of God in the Bible is that he is holy, holy, holy. Such repetition is the way biblical authors emphasize the importance of this attribute of God. We are to learn that it is a matter of central importance that God is devoted to himself. Now again, it doesn't mean that it is the greater attribute of the others. It just means he is the most holy of anything. Question number 6. What does God's holiness trigger the seraphim to do? I'm looking back to the passage in Isaiah.
Worship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, worship. They cry out to him. How is their worship manifested? There's a couple ways. There's multiple actions that they're doing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they are calling out in a song, right? Alvin pointed out at Ironman that they are singing in antiphony, that is call and response. That's the simple way to remember that. They are calling back and forth to each other as they sing this song and honor the Lord and his holiness. And then you see them covering. They cover their feet, which is a symbol of humility. Kind of think about when Moses approached the bush. God told him to take off his sandals because the ground he was standing on was made holy by God's presence. And then you see them cover their face. So here you have these pure angelic beings who are able to be in the presence of God, yet because of God's superlative holiness, they themselves cannot even look upon God. Question number 7. And if you were, before we go to question 7, I mean, the point is pointing, what is the significance? I guess I didn't ask that. What is the significance of all those actions? The covering the feet, the humility, the covering the face, the singing to the Lord. What's the significance of that? And you kind of go from the argument to the lesser to the greater with what Anne was saying, right? If the angels in heaven respond this way, who do not have sin in their life, how much more should we respond, right? If I'm using this to counsel somebody and help them understand the holiness of God, how much more should I be humbled at the thought of God's holiness? How much more should I cover myself because of my sinfulness? Cannot look upon God because he is holy. And how much more should I devote myself to continually singing and proclaiming the excellency of God? Question number 7. How would you define the holiness of God? How, you know, in your understanding of it, and we haven't said the definition of it, it's on the next page, don't look, don't cheat. But how would you describe or define the holiness of God? And what are maybe some synonyms or similar words you use to kind of express or describe it? Utterly set apart. Okay. Yeah. So we have utterly set apart, moral perfection, not stained by sin. Anything else?
The aim of revelation is a worthiness to praise.
Okay. A worthiness to be praised, so a quality of just being glorious and worthy, right?
It's transcendent. There's no one, you can't look around and find any being that is like this. Mm-hmm. It's unique, one of a kind. Transcends everything and everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Transcendent, if y'all didn't hear that. Transcendent, one of a kind, unique. Yeah, another great phrase, cut above the rest, separate. And Anne was kind of touching on question number 8 there. The Hebrew term for holy means to cut or to be separate, to be set apart. So how does that definition shape our understanding of holiness? You guys kind of already touched on it already.
Like him in his nature.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Yeah. The residual glory of God resting on you and making it unbearable for other people is.
That holiness is just indescribable.
R.C. Sproul, in his book, The Holiness of God, says this at the bottom of the page, page 2. We often describe God by compiling a list of qualities or characteristics that we call attributes. We say that God is a spirit, that he knows everything, that he is loving, just, merciful, gracious, and so on. The tendency is to add the idea of the holy to this long list of attributes as one attribute among many. But when the word holy is applied to God, it does not signify one single attribute. The word holy calls attention to all that God is. It reminds us that his love is holy love. His justice is holy justice. His mercy is holy mercy. His knowledge is holy knowledge. And his spirit is holy spirit. And so this is kind of pointing out what MacArthur was saying on page 1 a little earlier, that his perfections are indistinguishable from each other. He is all that he is. He is love. He is justice. He's not part love. He's not part justice. They all touch each other and are one. God is one in all that he is. He is loving in everything that he does. He is holy in all that he is. He is wrathful and just in all that he is. He is everything. He is not sometimes this, sometimes that. They touch each other. They are unified in all that he is. So you turn the page. I think you guys already nailed it with the definition. When we talk about God's holiness, it means that he is infinitely and transcendently separate from the world and thus the only being worthy of worship. Right? I'm trying to put it in one simple sentence. Again, R.C. Sproul says this when we're talking about that transcendent aspect of God. Transcendence describes his supreme and absolute greatness. The word is used to describe God's relationship to the world. He is higher than the world. It points to the infinite distance that separates him from every creature. He is an infinite cut above everything else. Right? And you're thinking on par with R.C. Sproul, isn't that cool? He is so far above and beyond us that he seems almost totally foreign to us. That is the holiness of God. So much when you read Exodus 15:11 there on page 3. Who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glorious deeds, doing wonders? So how is the transcendence of God captured in that verse? He's unlike anything else. You cannot compare God to anything. Because for him to be comparable to anything, would that make him not holy? That is why oftentimes you hear Alvin, I think I've said it before too, and others, like when you choose an analogy, you often hear us say, now this is where it breaks down. Right? We use analogies to try and help us wrap our minds around concepts and descriptions of God, but they ultimately will break down because God is holy. There is nothing like him. Nothing. The chasm between his being and ours is infinite. A.W. Tozer captures that feeling of like, how can I describe something that is infinitely greater, transcendent, and indescribable? He says, neither the writer nor the reader of these words is qualified to appreciate the holiness of God. Quite literally, a new channel must be cut through the desert of our minds to allow the sweet waters of truth that will heal our great sickness to flow in. We cannot grasp the true meaning of the divine holiness by thinking of someone or something very pure and then raising the concept to the highest degree we are capable of. God's holiness is not simply the best we know, infinitely bettered. We know nothing like the divine holiness. It stands apart, unique, unapproachable, incomprehensible, and unattainable. The natural man is blind to it. He may fear God's power and admire his wisdom, but his holiness he cannot even imagine. So, based on the definition, this is question number 10, of holiness above, what does it mean that all of God's attributes are holy? Now, this is going to have implications. This is going to bear out on all the lessons that we are going to hear on the attributes of God. Yeah, Adam.
That all these attributes are elevated to perfection beyond comparison, so that all of our definitions of these attributes are in terms of these perfections that God sets the standard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. God's attributes are perfect, and each one of them is transcendent and incomparable to anything we could even fathom. Even though holiness is a communicable attribute, which means it is one of those in which God can share and communicate to us and with us, and that we can ourselves exhibit in some form, not exactly like God. Same thing with love and mercy. Those are communicable attributes. Aseity, like Russell taught last week, is an incommunicable attribute. None of us are self-existent. We will never be self-existent. We will never be self-sufficient. Ever. We will always be dependent upon God. That's an incommunicable attribute. But all these communicable ones that we can ourselves, we can express goodness, kindness, mercy, love, but there's never an inkling like God's expression of who he is in his love, in his mercy, in his wrath, in his wisdom, his power, his knowledge. It's incomparable. Incomprehensible.
So, it takes me back to the question before here on why is it important to try to just think about God's protection.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'm a processor and I talk out loud to think through my thoughts, the verse about being held accountable for every word that we say just really hits with this. I mean, when we're trying to strive to talk about God and represent him accurately and rightly, we just have to be that much more careful. The importance of studying his word and accurately knowing who he is so that we can represent him in all his excellencies in a holy standard. That is also part of the sanctification process, because how I would have described God 10 years ago and how I would describe him now are going to be very different to me as I am sanctified.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And how much humbling it is to think that God uses our feeble attempts of explaining him and the gospel to save people. Right? My inadequate ability to describe and ascribe the glory that God is due, and to just accurately describe him as I ought to other people, and my feeble attempts at sharing the gospel, God uses to change and transform people despite my weakness. That is God's graciousness on display for sure, and his power. When we talk about God's holiness, oftentimes, when you play the word association game, the first thing that pops into people's heads is moral purity, and that's not wrong. But first and foremost, holiness is his transcendent being, is being completely separate from everything else in the world. And that impacts all of his attributes, including his morality. So yes, his holiness includes his morality. He is infinitely sinless and perfect and good in all that he does, which causes problems for us in our sinfulness, as we'll talk about just in a moment. But just at the bottom of page 3, there's a couple other examples of holiness applied to other perfections. Psalm 73, 13, your way, O God, is holy. What God is great like our God? So his way, his decisions, his sovereignty, his actions, his choices are holy. Isaiah 5:16, but the Lord of hosts is exalted in justice, and the holy God shows himself holy in righteousness. His righteousness is holy, distinguished, transcendent, far beyond any righteousness that we could ever dream of. Page 4, looking at, just in our remaining time, well, I think we might be able to get through this page, God's holiness and man's sinfulness. So if we continue on Isaiah 6, 3 through 8, and one called to another and said, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the foundations of the thresholds shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for. And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send, and who will go for us? Then I said, here I am, send me. And when we look at this passage, we see what happens when man's creatureliness and sinfulness comes into the presence of God's holiness. So in verse 5, how does Isaiah respond to the vision and revelation of God's holiness? Literally terror, right? Terrified. Wishing to, feeling like he's going to unravel and disintegrate. What else does he say? How else does he respond?
He's aware of his sin.
Okay. A sudden increase in awareness of his sinfulness, right? Absolutely. All of a sudden, I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. So not only was he aware of his own sin, but he even felt tainted just being around other people who were also sinful. He's aware not of only his own sin, but the sin of the world, the corruption of the world, just because he had seen the King. Why? Why did he feel this way?
Sure, he knows the scriptures that you see the face of God die. Mm-hmm. So I saw the face of God die.
Mm-hmm. And he'd be familiar with a few instances, which we're going to talk about in this next question, of what happens when people don't take seriously the holiness of God. At this point in time, Isaiah would have known of those accounts. When you talk about the holiness of God, when you saw the power of God, the trembling that came from his voice, but then the trembling that he felt, he sees his glory, he sees his authority, he sees him on the throne. And as Russell pointed out, he sees that his holiness also equates to his moral purity. And all of a sudden he sees how filthy he is and how I should not be here. I should not be here. This is not good.
How will you act? All the people are unclean.
Mm-hmm.
There's
Mm-hmm. All people are unclean, yeah. I mean, we think, when you go into somebody, maybe you visit someone's house, it's a really nice house. You know the kind of nice house where they have like a nice sitting room that's separate from like a living room, right? Really nice sofa, white carpet. And if you were to go in there and like accidentally spill your drink or bring mud on the floor, how bad you feel, like, oh, I am so sorry, right? And you're trying to be extra careful. You see that they've wrapped the sofa in plastic, or, you know, that kind of thing, or you're just like, ugh. If we feel like that in somebody's living room, imagine, obviously, exponentially increased the feeling of being in the presence of God with your sinfulness. Just doesn't even compare. Question number 12. What are some other examples in the Bible when man's sinfulness is confronted by God's holiness? You think of just maybe some accounts of what happened. I do have some scriptures there if you know what those accounts are.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. That's Leviticus 10 right there. Right. Failed to treat and respect God's holiness. He had set the standard for how they are to bring and offer incense, what they were supposed to use, but they did not obey him. They offered strange fire, and what happened?
God vaporized them,
consumed them in fire. Any other examples? Yeah, Adam. He did, yep. King Uzziah got cocky, and
all the priests challenged him to stop.
Yep.
He did it anyway.
Yep, and God struck him with what?
Leprosy.
Instantaneous leprosy. Had all these priests saying, don't do that, that is not your role, God would not like that. And he's like, I'm going to do it anyways. And God struck him with leprosy. That's a good example of not treating God's holiness properly. What else?
The New Testament, the Ananias and Sapphira, is that the same idea?
Sure, absolutely. Right? They lied, accused them of lying to the Holy Spirit. They thought they could get some of the glory of like, hey, I'm giving away money, and they say they're giving so much, but they lie about that in order to get glory from man, and God struck them down. Absolutely.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. In 2 Samuel 6:3, you have Uzzah and the ark. There was a prescribed way of carrying the ark. You had the poles and the rings on the ark. You were supposed to insert the poles through the rings and carry it that way. Uzzah did not adhere to that. They put the ark on a cart pulled by oxen. The ark was supposed to be the seat of God on earth. It was supposed to be holy. You're not supposed to touch it. And he put it on his cart, and the ox stumbled or hit a bump in the road. The ark started to fall. Uzzah reached out to touch it to save it from falling. It shouldn't have even been in that situation to begin with. And God struck him down.
I always felt
bad for him. I used to too, until you remember. It's like, oh, God laid out how they were supposed to do that.
I do.
David felt bad for him too. David was angry. And Aaron was angry when his sons Nadab and Abihu got consumed too. But then at the end, he was like, "I cover my mouth. Who am I, Adam?"
Was this a big mistake with assuming that his hand was any cleaner
than dirt? Yeah. Right. Another one that's there is the Deuteronomy 32:51, and that's where Moses is denied entrance to the promised land, because the Lord tells him, you did not treat me as holy.
Yeah.
The follow-up question would be, is how does God want us to respond to his holiness? And we are out of time. So, we will pick up that next week. And what we'll do is, after that, we'll kind of hit a real key passage that I think is a good one to have in the tool belt of biblical counselors, where you have 1 Peter 1, where you have God's attribute of holiness, and then the immediate application of that, right? As God who has called you is holy, you also be holy. We'll talk about that and flesh that out. And then the last thing we'll talk about God's holiness and our worship. And then we'll talk about God's holiness and our trials. How does God's holiness impact how do we handle trials? And that'll be the lesson on holiness. So, that's it for today. Thanks, guys.